From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, a debate on slavery in the Sudan. We'll hear from a 22-year-old Sudanese Dinka student who says he was enslaved for 10 years, a U.S. Congress member who was recently arrested in front of the Sudanese embassy for protesting slavery, as well as several others. And a Pacifica board lawyer sends a letter to a California judge requesting an unprecedented emergency board meeting to replace members of the Pacifica board who have resigned, with five new members, including former D.C. Mayor Marion Barry and Democratic Party activist Susan Estrich. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The New York Times reported yesterday that Florida election officials, under intense pressure from Republicans after the U.S. presidential election, accepted hundreds of overseas absentee ballots that failed to comply with state election laws. The newspaper, which conducted a six-month probe into the closest presidential election in U.S. history, says its study found no evidence of vote fraud by either the Republican or the Democratic parties. But the study did find that at least 680 of the 2,490 overseas ballots failed to comply with state election laws. According to the official tally released by Florida Secretary of State Catherine Harris, George Bush beat Al Gore by a 537-vote margin in Florida. One election expert estimated that Bush's margin would have been reduced to 245 votes had state election laws been closely adhered to for overseas absentee ballots. Had the manual recount in West Palm Beach, Florida, not been disqualified by Secretary of State Catherine Harris, Gore would have taken the state. The flawed votes included ballots without postmarks or postmarked after the election, and others that lacked witness signatures or were mailed from towns and cities within the United States. There were even ballots from voters who voted twice. The study also found noticeable differences in how Republicans asked Florida election officials to treat ballots with similar defects. Counties in which George Bush won the vote were four times as likely as counties carried by Gore to count ballots lacking witness signatures and addresses. Republican lawyers and officials push Florida election officers to bend or ignore election laws in order to count the maximum number of overseas military votes while challenging civilian absentee ballots with the same flaws. The Pentagon claims it destroyed a mock warhead on Saturday in a $100 million missile defense test that was greeted by international condemnation. Russia's foreign ministry said the Bush administration's testing for its missile defense plan, quote, threatens all international treaties on nuclear disarmament. The Pentagon had failed in three previous attempts to shoot down dummy ballistic missiles with interceptor rockets. 10 Greenpeace volunteers breached security at the Vandenberg Air Force Base in California to protest the missile defense test, while swimmers offshore dodged Coast Guards, a helicopter, and a Navy vessel to land on the base. They later took four inflatable boats into the testing area before being apprehended. Another 14 people were later arrested when FBI agents boarded a Greenpeace boat moored close to the base. A new report from the National Council of La Raza has concluded that Latinos in the United States still live in segregated neighborhoods and are less likely to own homes, save money, or have health insurance than whites. The Latino population in the U.S. has grown from an estimated 22 million in 1990 to more than 35 million in 2001. But income inequality between Latinos and other ethnic groups and whites has either remained stagnant or increased during the same period. The Council has called for increased support for language, education, and job training, among other measures it says would begin to reduce inequality of income and quality of life between Latinos and whites. The federal government has sued the city of New York for failing to protect women in the city's so-called workfare program from racial and sexual harassment, including harassment by supervisors. The program, which has been implemented by many states as they dismantle their welfare programs, requires recipients of public assistance to work often in low-wage jobs with no health or child care in exchange for their benefits. The suit seeks compensatory damages and demands that the city halt these practices. Employment law experts say it's unusual for the federal government to file such complaints, which arose only after failed attempts to negotiate a settlement on behalf of four workfare participants claiming sexual harassment and racial discrimination. About 100 people turned out in Tampa, Florida on Saturday night to protest the city's installation of dozens of surveillance cameras in the Ybor City District. The cameras scan the faces of passersby and compare them to a police database of more than 30,000 and relay requests to police on the street to stop anyone who resembles a picture in the database that they are concerned about. One protester carried a sign that read, "We're under house arrest in the land of the free," while others wore gas masks and Groucho Marx glasses to denounce the police efforts to put surveillance cameras in public places. Tampa is the only city in the U.S. where police use face recognition software for routine surveillance, but Virginia Beach, Virginia is seeking a $150,000 grant for a similar system. And delegates from 180 countries are gathering today in Bonn, Germany for a two-week UN conference on global warming. The conference will try and rescue the 1997 Kyoto Protocol from the staunch opposition of the United States. The protocol commits rich countries to cutting emissions of greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide from cars, factories, and power stations.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say, say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free. I wish
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. Nina Simone here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush's special humanitarian coordinator for Sudan began meetings with top Sudanese government officials yesterday. Andrew Natsios, the most senior U.S. government official to visit Sudan in 12 years, urged the Sudanese government to provide unimpeded access for food and medicine deliveries and said he would press Sudanese officials for a permanent halt in the bombing of hospitals, schools, and other civilian sites in the rebellious south. Sudan is under U.S. sanctions and on the State Department's list of nations that sponsor terrorism. Khartoum sees the U.S. envoy as a signal of a new U.S. policy towards Sudan. Bush is expected to name a high-level peace envoy soon, putting the United States for the first time in the forefront of efforts to negotiate an end to the 18-year-long civil war. The largely Muslim Arab North has waged nearly two-decade war to impose its authority in southern Sudan, whose people are African and practice either traditional religions or Christianity. The conflict has left 2 million people dead, 4 million displaced within Sudan's borders. 2 weeks ago, the Sudanese government accepted a Libyan-Egyptian peace initiative, which called for an interim government composed of all political forces, the recognition of religious, cultural, and ethnic diversity, respect for human rights, and freedom of speech. Oil has played a central role in the conflict. Humanitarian groups say oil extraction has, since its inception 2 years ago, intensified the Sudanese conflict and accused the government of pursuing a scorched earth policy and bombarding civilians living around the oil fields and even enslaving civilians to clear the land for oil extraction. Through a number of Asian and Western companies, including the Canadian giant Talisman, Sudan pumps out some 200,000 barrels of oil per day. And U.S. oil companies are taking an increased interest in the Sudan, where experts believe large petroleum reserves lay untapped. A Sudanese leader recently invited U.S. companies to expand their operations in the country. Today we're going to have a discussion and debate on the issue of slavery in the Sudan. We're going to begin with Francis Bach. He's a 22-year-old student now in Boston. I reached him last night about 1 in the morning. He was not able to join us live on the show as he is taking an English class at this time. But he talked about his experience in the Sudan, says he was enslaved for more than 10 years. This is Francis Bach's story.
My name is Francis Bach. In the year 1986, when I was 7 years old, my mother sent me to the market to sell eggs and beans. I went to the market. That's around evening time, 5 o'clock. And the militia Arab from north came and stormed the market. They start shooting the people. They shot the people in the heads, and they cut off the heads with swords. They captured women and children. I tried to run, and then I was caught by militiamen. They took me and other children as slaves. On the way, the two little girls were seeing their parents being killed. One is 12 years old, another 10 years old. The 12 years old were crying all the way, and the master said, shut up, and she couldn't stop crying. He took her out in the group and then he shot her in the head. Her little sister is still crying. Again, he took her out in the group and then he cut her foot off. He told us this is going to happen for everyone if you guys are crying out loud. On the way, they divided us to militiamen. I was given to a guy called Juma Abdallah. After I came to Juma Abdallah's house, he called all the old family to meet me. And they all had sticks. And they all beat me and they laughed. And they called me Abid, which is mean black slave. That was my welcome. He told me after they beat me that you're going to be sleep with animals, with the cows and horse and goat. And every morning he sent his son to come to beat me. And everyone came to make fun of me and say, Abid, black slave. After I grow up, at 10, 14 years old, he told me that I'm going to be take care of the animals. And whatever time when I came back from the forest, they beat me up. They said, you lost cows or you lost the goats. But nothing loose. They wanted me a reason to beat me. When I hear that, I tried to escape the first time when I was 14 years old. And I was caught. And then my mother beat me. And he told me, if you try it again, we're going to kill you. But I would rather die than be slave because I hear the way they treat me and the way they treat our slaves. I made a couple of days and I escaped again a second time. The second time when I was caught, my master beat me a lot. And he told me they're going to kill you this time because you don't want to listen to me. But I told him, I'm really sorry, very sorry. I'm not going to do that again. I'm going to stay with you forever. Until I made 3 more years, when I was 10, 17 years old, that I completely said, this time, I don't care what's going to happen to me. I want to go away. I want to find my parents. Or maybe I want to find someone who is going to be kind to me. I hate the way they treat me and the way I saw other slaves were treated badly. I escaped the third time until I went to a different town. In that town, I find someone who is a lorry driver. And I tell him to help me until he hit me in his lorry to bring me to a very big town called Dan in the North Sudan. And I made a couple months, 2 months with him, and after 2 months, he paid me bus ticket to come to capital, Khartoum. And I went to refugees camps where the people from South Sudan live, black. I stayed there until the person who I stayed with him is Southern Sudanese, and he knows someone working with Egyptian consulate in Khartoum, tried to help me to get a visa free to come to Egypt. Until I went to Egypt in Cairo. And 1999, that I flew to the United States as a refugee. And I went to Fargo, North Dakota. I stayed in Fargo, North Dakota until I feel isolated because I don't know anyone over there except my sponsor, the person who sponsored me to be in America. I tell him to move to Ames, Iowa because Ames, Iowa has Southern Sudanese community. I stayed in Iowa until there's a person who helped me in Egypt to write my story when I went to United Nations Refugees Office to accept my case. he came and he stayed in Massachusetts here in Lynn, and he met one of intern in America, anti-slavery group in Boston, and he told them about me that I had been slave for 10 years, and ASG tried to call me to move, which is Associate Director, American Anti-Slavery Group, Justice Says, called me a couple of times that I can move to Boston to join them to work with American Anti-Slavery Group. And I told them I don't want to move, and I don't want to speak again to the government in Khartoum because I'm not just the one who has been slaves. There's so many, million of, hundreds of thousands of them that are slaves. Most of them, they are here in America and somewhere in Canada, Australia. Why they are silent? They should speak too. I'm not the one who is slave. I don't want to tell my story because I'm scared. And also, I'm too young. I'm 22 years old. I just turned 22 years this year. And that was, last year was 21. And I tell them I don't want to speak. And the third, I don't speak language, English, because I just got here and I'm starting to learn English first. And I don't want to tell my story because it really painful to me when I remember what happened to me in the past when I was little. That's making me cry again. And they try to tell me that you have to forget what you're saying and can tell your story, but not just your story. Tell a story of South Sudanese, your people, whom have been slaves and killed, to tell their story, also to speak to the people who they cannot speak. The 27 million people are still left around the world. A couple of times until I realized, and I moved to Boston last year, May 14, and I made a couple of weeks, and then they took me to Washington, D.C. The first time ever I never spoke to the group, 400, 500 people, or 600 in the room, that I spoke before Congress in Capitol Hill when they called my name, that we need Francis to speak. I really don't know what to say. I know what to say in my language, in Dinka, and also I know what to say in Arabic, but I don't know how to translate that to the people to understand what happened to me. But when they called my name, I said, God, please open my heart to speak to this crowd of people, to tell them something that, to understand what happened to me. And I spoke that day. When I came back to Boston, I tried to study hard, English. I went to school to take course. And the American Anti-Slavery Group tried to help me to get good at school until I made a couple of months and I went back to Washington, D.C., which I testified to the Senate. On the same day, I met with Secretary of State Milton Albright to tell a story. And when I came back here, I tried to speak a lot of schools, a lot of high schools, a lot of colleges, a lot of universities, and a lot of churches, and a lot of Jewish synagogues. And also, I've done a lot of TV shows and a lot of radio talk shows to tell a story over and over, not just my experience and what I had been through, but I'm telling a story of South Sudanese. I'm telling the hundreds of thousands of children who are still left today in Sudan. That's why I'm here. And I said, I mentioned that when I was speaking to Senate, I said, in this country, the blasting country, America, the land of freedom, everybody was free. I would say I'm free. I'm a lucky man. But what is good man freedom if my people are still dying? What is good man freedom if my people are still slaves? And I said, as long as they have no voice, I must be their voice to speak to them. That's why I'm using my freedom, to free my people, also to free other people that cannot speak, not just South Sudanese. But I'm here working with American Anti-Slavery Group. We have all of us, South Sudanese, to tell their story and also to help me to tell my story and also to stop people who they think they're better off to be violent to other humans. That's why I'm here. I'm 22 years old, but I know this is really hard to me to do and very dangerous to me. But I'm doing because I'm a witness of the people who had been shot. I'm a witness of people, a lot of children, hundreds of thousands who still left today in North Sudan. That's why I tell my story over and over. And also to tell the world to join these people who they think they're better off than us. because, and I mentioned that why Walpa has been silent. So many years, the slavery still exists in Sudan. Most people believe that slavery was ended in 1865 in this country, in America. And today we're talking about slavery will exist than ever before. And that we should make it clear, if you think slavery was ended, think again. Go to website, and I like that the people going to listen to go to website, our website, which is www.iabolish.com, and they can learn more what we're doing, we American Anti-Slavery Group, what I myself, Francis, doing here in Boston, speaking, 22 years old. I should rest my life in normal life to do what a student can do and do other normal thing in my life. By resting my life to do this important work because I'm important to my people. And I want to thank God that he encouraged me and he gave me this opportunity to speak to my people that I can't be silent. I can't be silent. I have to speak to my people until the world is going to take action or the government in this country, America, can do something to my people. We are really serious. Talk to people who they say there's no slavery today, especially in Sudan. And I know whom people are talking because we have big conflict. The people who say there's no slavery today, if I don't want to have, let them call up in office. Let them talk to me, talk to other people. If you think there's no slavery, you can go to Southern Sudan. There's a lot of people go to Southern Sudan to see in their own to be witness. If you see that North level Sudan, go to South Sudan and see. There's so many things happening in Sudan as we're talking today. The children are still left today. They're laying the ground. They're waiting for strong people. That's why we are doing this work. And I hope that the people going to listen to these messages can make a difference to us and also to make a difference to 27 million people still left around the world. And also to make a difference to people that cannot speak. That's what I can say.
Francis Bach, he's 22 years old. He is Dinka from Southern Sudan. Says he was enslaved for 10 years and now has come to this country, is learning English, and is an associate with the American Anti-Slavery Group based in Boston. When we return, we'll get a response from the director of the Center for Strategic Studies in the Sudan. We'll also be joined by a former Sudanese government official who is currently in exile in London, and New Jersey Congressmember Don Payne, who got arrested outside the Sudanese embassy last week. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. We just heard the story of Francis Bach, 22 years old. Dinka from Southern Sudan says he was enslaved for 10 years in Northern Sudan and now has come to this country to campaign against modern-day slavery. We're also joined on the telephone by Saeed El-Khatib, who is the director of the Center for Strategic Studies in the Sudan. He joins us now from Washington, D.C., where he is visiting. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you respond to Francis Bach's story?
Well, I don't want to get into I am not going to call his story untrue. But I would take issue with some of the statements that he made, namely that he said slavery still exists in Sudan, and this is what I disagree with him saying. Slavery has been illegal in Sudan since before independence. The laws of the land do not tolerate slavery. And in our zone, where Francis Buck comes from, practices that are illegal could very well be going on there. The government of Sudan is trying to account for cases of abductions or holding people against their will or forcing them to go in labor. One thing that I noted in his story is that he said he was captured in 1986, which was about 3 years before this government took office in 1989. It is difficult to account for each and every single case of abductions, but the government has set up a committee called the Committee for the Eradication of Abductions of Children and Women. This committee is working with UNICEF. UNICEF seems to be convinced that the work that is done by this committee is credible and good. They are funding some of their activities. And their reports show that they were able, for example, to account in the last year for about upwards of 250 cases of abductions of children and women, and reuniting these people with their families. But I don't accept that there is slavery in Sudan. There are about 2.5 million southern Sudanese who fled the war and are living now in northern Sudan. And logic and respect for these people would, you know, have us believe that if there was slavery in northern Sudan, these people would have, you know, sought sanctuary elsewhere, either in Uganda or Kenya or Ethiopia, lands that are accessible to them if actually they would be enslaved in northern Sudan. This is a campaign to defame the whole nation of Sudan. You know, people are now, many people believe that the people of Sudan, you know, deal in the freedom of each other. They are buying and selling each other, which is simply not true.
Let's bring Bona Malwal into this conversation, speaking to us from London, former minister in the government of Southern Sudan, currently the publisher of the Sudan Democratic Gazette. Your response to Saeed El-Khatib, whether slavery exists today in the Sudan?
Well, I don't want to respond to a person who obviously is trying to spin a government propaganda line and just becomes a worthless kind of a conversation. I think what is best to say is that, you know, if Khatib says that, you know, the government is taking action, the government is accused, you know, the young man who spoke, this Dinka young man who spoke, says that he was captured by government militias. From my own personal knowledge and testimony, I know that slavery is part of the war policy. The government uses slavery to capture people into slavery as a way of demonizing the people of southern Sudan and the way of humiliating the people that it regards as enemies of the state. And I couldn't agree with Francis more that, you know, slavery does exist in southern Sudan, and slavery is at best condoned by government, at worst encouraged by government, because it is the government militias that capture these people into slavery. And I think so that there is no doubt left in the mind of any listener to this program. Slavery is not being practiced in the traditional way whereby people are sold and bought for commerce. It is part of a government policy that anything that the militias capture in southern Sudan or loot in southern Sudan, including women and children, are personal property of the people who capture and loot them. And that's why Francis says he was employed in the, to look after goats and cattle and horses of the of his master. And so there is no commerce in that sense. And so Khatib can say, with brazen face that there is no slavery because, yes, he can claim that there are no trade markets for slaves. Now, as far as the truth of the matter is concerned, if the government is serious about, combating slavery, it is really incredible that a government representative like Khatib says slavery doesn't exist, a charge of a crime as heinous as slavery, the government should come forward and constitute an independent international body to become clean. The government appoints its own committee and then brings in UNICEF. UNICEF has really shamed itself by becoming, a whitewash for government propaganda. We would like to see a government decision that allows international bodies to be set up to investigate, go into southern Sudan, go into the war zone and find out whether there is slavery or not. I keep going to southern Sudan, frequently myself, and I have seen women and children whose, and families whose children have been captured into slavery. So I am a personal testimony to this fact, to the existence of slavery. But the point is, we can't argue it over the radio internationally and abroad. I challenge Khatib to ask the government to come clean and open, set up an international body that can investigate and bring an independent report that slavery doesn't exist in Sudan. Slavery is part of a government policy, of dehumanizing and humiliating the people of southern Sudan and show them. It is part, in fact, of encouraging government militias and government forces to commit crimes in southern Sudan, because if the government doesn't take action against those who commit these crimes, then the ordinary soldier, uneducated as many of them are, then feels that any crimes that they commit are crimes that are committed within the law. And so what needs to be done is for Khatib to assure us now, tell us that he will persuade his government to set up an independent body, not a government committee, and then co-opt UNICEF to whitewash the reports of this committee, because,
Well, Saeed El-Khatib, what about an independent body investigating this?
Well, first of all, if Mr. Malwal thinks that UNICEF is impartial and has been co-opted by the government, then any other kind of body that might be, called upon by the government to participate in this could, be accused of the same. And because for Mr. Malwal and others, this is a political thing. They are dissatisfied with this government, and they want, they will do everything they can to paint a picture of this government as something out of the Stone Ages, and make it easy for governments who want to take action, or forces that want to take action against it, to make that justified. I think this is what this campaign is all about. UNICEF is impartial to me. It's part of the United Nations. It's an international thing. Nobody could accuse, and credibly accuse the government of Sudan of being such a weak government, of being able to co-opt UNICEF to make them change their procedures and the principles they work for, and just be, a surrogate to the government. We're doing the dirty work of the government of Sudan.
Just let me interrupt for a second, because we also have New Jersey Congressmember Don Payne on the line, who two Fridays ago, I believe, was arrested in front of the Sudanese embassy in Washington, D.C. Why did you get arrested?
Well, I felt that more attention had to be drawn to the situation in the Sudan, and I think that we certainly, it's great to hear from actual Sudanese, and I compliment you for having Sudanese who have experienced slavery, those who have investigated it, so that they can tell their story. I've heard the stories. I've visited the south of Sudan on several occasions, two or three occasions over the past 10 years. And I have seen some of the horrific conditions in Sudan. I believe that slavery is certainly one of the issues that we need to really confront. But the gentleman representing the government, there are a number of situations that makes this government in Khartoum a pariah government. Number one, they control the Operation Lifeline Sudan, which is a UN-run operation that has to get permission from the government to fly in to deliver food. And in 1998, thousands of people died because they would not allow the OLS to go in. The fact that the government does aerial bombing, which they admit, in the year 2000, there were 167 different bombings. And I have each one of them listed in front of me, the dates and the destruction. It's a government that...
It's also the case that the U.S. has bombed the Sudan, bombed a pharmaceutical factory there under the Clinton administration.
It's one thing for one country to bomb another, and I don't believe in that. It's another thing for people to bomb their own people. And so I think that if you're comparing the U.S.'s bombing of the factory that they felt had some strategic military terrorists,
well, it seems they've gone back on that at this point.
Well,
not as well reported.
Yeah, well, they thought that they were doing the right thing at the time. It's not uncommon that errors are made, and the truth will finally... But if you are comparing the U.S. bombing that one building once and 167 bombings that people have dropped on hospitals and villages and schools, then I'm a little...
No, I just wanted to remind people
that
that
I know that,
that
there was a bombing, but when you put that in, then you're almost justifying the government bombing its people.
I was just raising the issue as a fact, but let me ask Bona Mawal, the former minister in the government of southern Sudan, who's now at Oxford, about the issue of oil and the role that you feel it plays in its relation, and is it related to the issue of slavery?
Well, the oil issue is worse than being related to slavery. What is happening now is that, you know, the government is adopting a scorched earth policy of destroying villages and the communities that are in it, in the areas where there is oil, with impunity. And so, you know, oil has become a real curse on the southern Sudanese population. And when a government that is not known to care about its own citizens in southern Sudan has become so greedy about oil, it will go out, of course, and sweep the whole territory, destroying every living thing, not just human beings. And this is exactly what is happening. And so oil has exacerbated the war situation in southern Sudan in a terrible way. And I think that, you know, even the representative of the government, if he's honest with himself, wouldn't deny the fact that, you know, the government is now really depopulating, deliberately depopulating the oil areas. And you see, that goes to the heart of the conflict in Sudan. You see, the conflict in Sudan between southern Sudan and northern Sudan has never been about people and about equality of people. It has always been about resources, hidden resources that were not there. And the oil is just showing us, you know, the government is almost gone totally reckless. You know, helicopter gunships are killing, you know, cattle nomads, you know, in the Nuer territory where the oil has been found. And really, whatever the oil companies, talisman and whoever is involved in the oil company in Sudan might say, they are simply just excusing and justifying their being tainted in the crime of genocide that is being committed in the name of oil.
Saeed Al-Khatib.
Yes, ma'am.
If you could respond to what Bona Mawal has said, yes, against Saeed Al-Khatib, director of the Center for Strategic Studies in the Sudan.
But if you allow me to respond to a couple of points that Mr. Payne has raised also.
Yes, we've just coming to the end, though, of this discussion, so make it as quickly
Very
as you
quickly.
Can.
Very quickly. He says that the government controls the Operation Lifeline Sudan. The government is cooperating with the United Nations in an operation called Lifeline Sudan that is not controlling it. He talked about the aerial bombardment. The government has offered in the IGAD summit at the beginning of last month an internationally monitored ceasefire. That is the answer to that. The government has put that offer on the table. The SPLA, SPLM has rejected it. So the people who should be held responsible for the hostilities going on are clear here. What is the part that wants the war to go on? Stopping the war, declaring a ceasefire, would mean that aerial bombardment would cease and the international supervision. As to Mr. Malwa's claim that the government is depopulating the oil areas in the south, the government has installations there. Any government should responsibly protect. This is for the Sudanese people, and the government's responsibility is to protect the oil installations. The SPLA, SPLM, and the NDA, these are groups that are fighting the government, have vowed publicly that they are going to attack these installations, and they are the ones who are waging this war to stop, because they have this notion that, you know, the oil is making the government stronger. The oil is for the Sudanese people. It is something that the people have been waiting for. And now they have a chance at a decent life, at development. Some people are out there to deprive them of that chance. And I think the government would be justified in defending these installations, having declared its willingness to accept an internationally monitored ceasefire.
We are rapidly approaching the break, so I want to give New Jersey Congressmember Don Payne a last quick comment.
Okay, the gentleman has not denied that there were 167 bombings of civilian sites. Number two, no plane can fly into Sudan, especially now with new equipment that has been bought, without the permission of the government of Sudan. OLS and the United Nations has an agreement that the government has said in 1998. And why would you stand on the talk on the radio and say that it does not happen? They would not allow the flights to come in.
It is not true.
And finally, the whole question of there should be impartial group. UNICEF has been opposed to the whole question and has denied that slavery existed from the beginning. There's been a big debate where they have said to the anti-slavery group, all we want to do is to feed children. That's what their expertise is. Bring in political experts to see about what's going on, not humanitarian food feeding children, rearing UNICEF. That's not a group that can have a direct
door.
Thank you.
I want to thank you all very much for being with us. We're going to continue to pursue this issue. New Jersey Congressmember Don Payne, who was recently arrested in front of the Sudanese embassy in Washington, D.C. Saeed Al-Khatib, director of the Center for Strategic Studies based in the Sudan, and Bono Mawal, former minister in the government of Southern Sudan, currently the publisher of the Sudan Democratic Gazette, which is published in exile from London. He's been speaking to us from Oxford. Our first guest on today's program was Francis Bach, who is a Dinka student now in Massachusetts, who described his story of being enslaved for 10 years. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll take a look at the latest controversy here at Pacifica. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. The conflict at Pacifica Radio is intensifying. Attorneys for the current majority on the Pacifica Board of Directors last week requested an unprecedented emergency board meeting to elect five new board members. The board meeting is scheduled for tomorrow via conference call. The request, dated July 10th and sent to the Alameda, California County Superior Court judge overseeing the three lawsuits pending against the board majority, cites the need to replace several board members who have resigned or wish to resign as a result of a national pressure campaign. In the letter, the Pacifica lawyer names the five proposed new members. They include former Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry, Susan Estrich, who is the campaign manager for Michael Dukakis' presidential run and is a well-known TV commentator and Democratic activist, and activist Dick Gregory. The move is the latest in an intense battle over control of the network. In August of 1999 in Berkeley, California, Pacifica management shut down Pacifica's first station, KPFA, for 23 days, which ultimately led to protests of 10,000 in the streets, and the station was reopened. In New York this past December, Pacifica moved in on WBAI and changed the locks, fired the station manager, the program director, and a union steward. Since then, protests around the country have increased. We invited on the program today representatives of the majority on the Pacifica board, and we're sorry they cannot join us after repeated requests. Ken Ford, the vice chair of the board, and John Murdoch, head of the governance committee, the two people that Ford said could address this issue, both declined a live interview. Ken Ford said he was in a plane this morning, but they also declined to be taped. Both wanted to do the program on Wednesday after the judge's ruling tomorrow. In the interest of fairness, though, we'll read the letter from Pacifica lawyer Daley Temchin that he wrote to the judge last week. Daley Temchin is with the law firm Epstein, Becker & Green and is employed by the Pacifica Foundation. This is an extended excerpt of that letter. It says, an unrelenting personal campaign against the majority directors attacking their livelihoods and the peaceful enjoyment of their homes has compelled three of them to resign in order not to jeopardize their jobs and their families' well-being. This week, for example, a prospective client of an enterprise with which one of the directors has a professional relationship was picketed, placing in jeopardy an extremely important assignment. Two critical points stand out. The client was scheduled to enter into a contract with the enterprise that very day, and the only likely means by which the identity of the prospective client and that circumstance could have been known to the protesters is that one or more of them hacked into the computer systems of the director or the enterprise with which she has a relationship, or both. goes on to say yet another director has received threatening calls to the effect that a complaint would be filed against her with a state licensing agency. The caller made it clear to the director her resignation from the Pacifica board would prevent the filing of that complaint. This is extortion. The Pacifica lawyer went on to write, as a consequence of this campaign, more directors have been forced to consider resignation. The status quo will be further altered and needs to be restored for a number of reasons. Chief among these is that further resignations prior to the election of new directors places at risk the foundation's FCC broadcast licenses. These resignations very likely would be perceived as an unauthorized transfer of control over those licenses by the FCC. At the end of the letter, Daily Temchin lays out the following individuals will be nominated as directors to replace those who have been compelled by unlawful harassment to resign as directors, and it names them Susan Estrich, Marion Barry, James Ferguson, Dick Gregory, and George Barristone. An earlier draft of this letter, which was leaked to KPFA, refers to the, quote, unrelenting, unlawful, and extortionate behavior of partisans directed against the directors of the Pacifica Foundation. It calls members of the Pacifica campaign and other dissident groups, quote, self-appointed terrorists, and refers to their totalitarian and fascist approach, which has included protests and pickets against Pacifica National Board members. Again, the last member of that five-member group proposed is George Barnstone. We are joined on the phone now by Leslie Kagan, who is a member of the Pacifica board, a minority member, and Bernard White, who is the former program director at WBAI, who was fired and banned from the station in December. Leslie Kagan, can you explain the significance of the meeting that has been requested for tomorrow? A judge will rule on this apparently today or tomorrow. Thank you for joining us.
Sure. Hi. Yes, obviously this is a very important development and something that we, that is myself and the other plaintiffs in the four different legal actions that are now moving to the court system, are quite concerned about. And among the plaintiffs, all five of what we call the dissident board members, are included. And we, that is the five dissident board members and the rest of the plaintiffs, all feel that this is really an effort. It really actually is a recognition that those people, both on the board, the dissident board members, and the activist community around the country, are in fact winning this struggle. And that, by that I mean that we are moving closer toward the day when the people who have been in the leadership of the national board and taking the Pacifica Foundation and the five stations in a direction away from the historic mission of Pacifica, that those people will no longer be in control. And we really see this as almost like a last-ditch effort to bring other forces onto the board. One of the striking things about all this, of course, is that we, the board members, have not been given resumes or any information. We don't even know what cities these people live in, if they live in the five signal areas, what their relationship to Pacifica or the five stations or to radio or to broadcast media is, and if they have, and what skills or expertise they have that might be useful on a board like this.
Well, what do their resumes say?
We haven't seen resumes. We've been given no information. The only information we have was that letter that you just read from that went to our lawyers. We have gotten nothing as board members. We weren't asked when is a convenient time to have a meeting. We also raised that concern that we, the National Board of Pacifica Radio, are mandated to have open public meetings. What plans are in place to make this conference call meeting an open public meeting so that listeners and others, you know, around the country will know what's happening on the Pacifica board. We think this is a gross violation of a mandate that we must respect. So there are many, many problems with this effort, but at the same time, we are hopeful that our arguments are strong and clear and that the court will agree with us that the board majority should not be allowed to go ahead and have this meeting tomorrow.
The board breakdown is seven Pacifica directors. versus five dissident, as they're known, board members, which include Leslie Kagan. Your side, if you will, presented their arguments on Friday to the judge in a brief today. Daily Temchin presents the arguments of the majority by noon today, and then the judge decides. Bernard White, you are part of the Pacifica campaign, which Juan Gonzalez, the former co-host of Democracy Now!, began when he resigned publicly on Democracy Now! January 31st and said he wouldn't return until the board of directors resigned. You've heard the comments of Daley Temchin in the letter, the lawyer, and the former draft talking about self-appointed terrorists and the totalitarian and fascist approach. Can you respond to this?
Well, first of all, good morning, Amy. I think that, you know, this is just some attorney jargon that is designed to paint the campaign in a negative light, that the activities of the campaign have been, we've operated under constitutionally protected, a resistance that has been constitutionally protected, that we have not gone outside of that. I'm sure that if we had and they could document it, that they would have pursued us in the courts. But, you know, one of the things that we have constantly talked about is that we will not, this is not violent, we will not be violent, that we are not going to pursue any course that would have incorporated in it any violence at all. We're trying to apply pressure, that is correct, to the board members who are on the board to do the right thing. I'm just listening to Leslie. She was saying that the five dissidents were excluded. Well, I've talked to some of those people who are part of the majority, and they, too, have been excluded. So it seems that it's just a small, very small group of people on the national board that are making the decisions. These names of people that have been given out, I mean, you know, where do they come from? We have submitted names from this Signal area, and I don't know if you remember that at the national board meeting that was held in Houston, that although those names were sent in with the registered receipt, that Bessie Wash and her staff signed for them, they claim that they did not have them and they knew nothing about them. So, you know, there's just a small group of folks who are maneuvering this entire thing to make it appear that the people who are in opposition to it are crazy.
Leslie Kagan, what do you make of the point charge made in the letter that the broadcast license of the network is at risk? It would constitute a change in ownership if board members resigned, leading to the dissident board members having the majority.
Right. We think this is totally ridiculous. First of all, boards change all the time. You know, people step down, new people are brought on. I mean, that happens all the time, including boards of radio stations that have licenses at the FCC. I've only been on the board a year, but when I came on, I was part of a group of five people that came on all at once. And since then, I think a total of five people have stepped down. So there's all kinds of turnover all the time. This is, we think, and our lawyers believe that this is just a bogus, you know, trying to set off an alarm, a bogus claim that really has no basis in fact. And we're concerned that, in fact, that Daley Temchin, the lawyer for the present board majority, would invoke the FCC. This is a matter that we have. It's a complicated struggle, and people feel very strongly on all sides of this issue. But this is a struggle that we have to sort out among ourselves, and there really is no reason to call in the FCC on
this. Well, we hope to continue this discussion. Hopefully, the board members can forge. John Murdoch will join us later in the week, and we could have an extended discussion with those of you who are opposing them. We thank you very much for being with us, Bernard White and Leslie Kagan, board member and banned and fired WBAI program director. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, Anthony Salone, our engineer. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of the banned and the fired, from the studios of your listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.